Thank you, David, and thanks everybody for coming and stuffing in to the room. So yeah, this program is directed at really many, many questions, but a large fraction of them can be in one way or another absorbed into this one bigger question: what is string theory? And to start off, I'll give the zeroth order textbook answer and explain why it's not adequate. And the program is divided, especially the first part, into a series of focus periods, overlapping focus periods. And the first one, which just concluded, was very directly aimed at this question, string field theory. The second, which is still ongoing, is also connected to pure spinors. And the third, which is just beginning, is integrability and ADS-CFT. And again, I'll try to thread these all together. And actually, there's much more that happens after this, but I think this is a good outline for an hour, and then maybe I can just say a few words about the future. So what is string theory? And the zeroth order question is, string theory is about quantizing one-dimensional objects, either closed loops or open strings whose ends are, at least in the first example, free to move. And both of these cases will be interesting. And just classically, to describe their dynamics, you need an action. And the simplest, there's a very simple geometric action: as the string, either kind of string, moves in time, it sweeps out a world sheet. And a nice geometric action is just the, which preserves all of the symmetries of space-time, is the area of the world sheet. Times a constant, the string tension, and with a minus sign to make it right. And this action gives you equations of motion, which describe the string having a center of mass motion through space and internal vibrations. And so by quantizing those internal vibrations, you get a bunch of internal levels, which are supposed to be different particle states. So that's the classical theory. And the quantum theory is just to integrate over all histories, weighted by e to the I times the action. And and this gets you quite far. In particular, one of the neat things is that although this picture I've drawn here is just a string propagating freely, this rule here automatically incorporates interactions, because I can imagine, for example, a process in which the two strings join and then split again. Or another process, actually the same process, but kind of seen in a different limit, in which a string comes in, emits a virtual string, which the other string absorbs. And without any new ingredients, the sum over histories incorporates both of these processes and all sorts of higher order ones as well. Now, one of the first nice things that happens is that when you quantize the closed strings, one of the low-lying excitations is a massless spin 2 field, which has, when you work out its interactions, the interactions of a graviton. So this includes... By the way, please feel free to ask questions anytime. Yes?
So can I have a string which sort of splits into two in the histories?
Well, so that's what this has done. This one has two have joined, and then it's split into.
I see. But yeah. Can I have just one starting off?
Yeah. You could have one. I mean, this... There. That's... all of these things. This is T goes to W and up. No, he goes W and D. Yes, but all of these things can happen. So one of the nice things is that, although it wasn't the intention, when you quantize the closed ones, you find that you're inevitably you have gravity in there. And when you look at the interactions of the graviton, so ordinary quantized Einstein theory, where the coil here is a graviton, is non-renormalizable. The amplitudes diverge when, okay, the first one that diverges is the one loop amplitude. It diverges when all of these interactions get close together in space-time. And the corresponding string process, which is again just a sum world sheet with the same kind of topology, looks like that, doesn't have the same divergence because the finite size of the string spreads it out in space, and there is no singular point where all of the where everything comes together. Everything is kind of, there's a characteristic size to the string which comes dimensionally from that tension, and below that scale everything is soft. So you get a theory of gravity which respects all the symmetries and everything, and moreover the amplitudes don't have the infinities of field theory. And that's very striking. Of course, in the infinities of quantum field theory have always been both a challenging problem, going back to the self-energy of the electron, both a challenging problem but also a guide to the correct theory. For example, in the case of the weak interaction, you start with the four Fermi theory, which has also bad infinities. And just the requirement of resolving the infinities pretty much tells you that you have to resolve the interaction into the exchange of W and Z bosons. And long before the W and Z were seen directly, not only their existence, but their rather detailed properties, masses and couplings, were fixed by just this requirement of having a theory that gives finite answers to physically meaningful questions. So finding here, of course, the problem is resolved by replacing one quantum field theory, one theory of point particles, with just a larger collection of point particles. Gravity seems to resist that. There's no obvious way to do that, and it seems to require sort of moving up to something different.
What's the status of? I mean, I thought it wasn't completely proven yet that, like, if you have any number of holes, that it's really finite, right?
The short answer is yes. You do the one loop calculation and you see that the region that would normally diverge is absent. You also see rather generally that any potentially divergent region is not really a short distance divergence, but an infrared divergence coming from parts of the world sheet becoming far apart. And so in fact, these should be absent too, but they're a different sort of animal. Let me actually come back to that question at an appropriate time. Yeah. There is actually a proof which, if somebody in this program would supply it, would be a nice contribution to the literature. I'll say more about that at the appropriate time. Okay. So this is the zero. This is kind of the way any colloquium on string theory starts. And the question is, you know, what is lacking in this answer? And what's lacking is this. This, what I'm describing here, this sum over world sheets, is directly analogous to the Feynman diagram in quantum expansion in quantum field theory. Actually, this diagram here describing scattering of gravitons is really the third in an infinite sum. The first would be the two gravitons propagating along and not talking to each other. The second, they would exchange one virtual particle. And here they exchange two. And so there's a coupling constant in the theory. And so this is of order g to the zero. This is of order g squared. This is of order g to the fourth. So when you know sort of this about string theory, you know pretty much exactly the same as in quantum field theory when you know how to write down the rules for Feynman graphs and evaluate individual Feynman graphs. But in both quantum field theory and in string theory, this sum doesn't converge. It's asymptotic, and so it has a precise meaning that's useful, but it doesn't converge, and therefore it doesn't converge for any, its radius of convergence is strictly zero. And again, it's asymptotic, so it has meaning, but it doesn't provide in any sense a definition, an answer to this question. If you wanted to, yeah. If you wanted to know what is a theory, even at g equals 1/100, what is it exact? You know, how do I calculate without using perturbation theory? It doesn't provide a rule. And we also know that many important qualitative aspects of physics are not captured by this kind of series. So in the standard model, there is quark confinement, dynamical symmetry breaking, instantons. And actually another instanton effect, violation of Baryon number by the weak interaction. And all of these are important for, you know, how the universe is the way it is or how it got here, how it got to its current state. And none of them are captured by the series. They require some understanding of quantum field theory that goes beyond just adding up Feynman diagrams. And so in the case of quantum field theory, this answer was provided by Ken Wilson about 40 years ago. So in the case of quantum field theory, there was a similar period of, you know, not knowing what the theory is. Certainly, the first effective Feynman diagram calculations in the late 40s up until the mid to late 60s, there was great confusion as to how you went from what was the whole theory. And it was Ken Wilson who gave the modern answer to this question, an effective answer, which is, well, first of all, you can think of the Feynman diagrams, the amplitudes. Okay, there are some of Feynman diagrams. But also, this is asymptotic to the real thing, which is a path integral over field histories. So we've jumped from particles to fields. Phi here, so in particular, phi is something which would be the field. Phi is a function of space-time. It would create and destroy particles. But Wilson did more, of course, than Feynman wrote down the path integral. What Wilson explained, this is just a symbolic thing because you're integrating over functions. And what does this mean? And Wilson provided the answer. It requires not just mathematical definition, but actual physical input. The right way to think about this integral is via the renormalization group, scale by scale. And when you do that, you both understand what it means as a precise thing, but also you learn a lot about what the physics is that descends from it. Okay, so this is part one. And having said what I just said about quantum field theory, one guess as to how to solve the same problem for string theory would be string field theory. So you would have a field, I'll make it a capital letter here, which instead of creating something at a point, it creates a loop. So it's a function of a function of sigma, sigma's that, so it creates a string at a point. And then we would do some really big functional integral over these functions of functions with some appropriate action, and we'd be done. So you can actually go fairly far in this direction. So, okay, here's your function of a function. I won't keep writing the of sigma inside. It's a function of a function. Actually, so I'm going to write the explicit form of this action S in what there's various ways to implement this, and I'm going to do one which is kind of the niftiest. It's also the nifty. Well, I'll explain why it's the niftiest in a second. So when we describe the string in however many space-time dimensions, let's just say we're in four just to keep it simple for now, we'd have four coordinates here. But this is really an overcounting. It's similar when you, to an electromagnetism, the vector potential has four components, but there are only two physical polarizations of the photon, and so there are various ways to proceed. You can fix a gauge, but that breaks covariance, or you can work with all four polarizations, but you have to have some kind of bookkeeping that two of them don't count. And in fact, you can do that here. You can keep the extra polarizations to keep a covariant description, but add a couple of ghost fields, which with appropriate, again, machinery, just cancel the unwanted polarizations and leave you with the physical ones. And the machinery, in fact, is something called the BRST operator. It's familiar, again, from quantizing gauge theories. So again, just taking the how you quantize gauge theories covariantly, there is a machinery for subtracting out the unwanted polarizations. It involves this thing called the BRST operator, which is somehow built out of the gauge symmetry and has this interesting property that square is zero. Come back to that in a second. And now we can build an action which is invariant under this. I want to save that picture for a little bit. So I'll write down here. So this is going to be a little bit symbolic. I'm not going to define everything. But OK, this describes free strings. And then actually, there's an interacting piece. And there's a corresponding interacting piece here. Yeah. Now, the condensed matter physicists in the audience should recognize this, could look at it a little bit, because that's a Chern-Simons action. Q here is like the exterior derivative, the curl, which has, you know, the curl that in as Wheeler says, the boundary of a boundary is zero. This is the same statement. And if you just translate Q into D and phi into the gauge field, you'll recognize this as being the Chern-Simons action. This is a very beautiful thing. So you have this this gauge invariance, and you can preserve this gauge invariance in an interacting theory. It contains actually This discussion, let's say, well, certainly starting here, only works for the open string. And there are some interesting asymmetries between open and closed strings that will come up as we go along. Here's the first one. So for open strings, there's this nice action, which looks very, very much like the action that one uses to describe the quantum Hall system, if you just, again, replace this with D and this with the vector potential. And in fact, one of the components of the open string field is a massless gauge field, although, in fact, what if you pick out this component of this actually reduces to not a Chern-Simons action, but somewhat surprisingly a Maxwell action for the gauge field. But this is nice. It has lots of symmetry. And in fact, if you do perturbation theory with this, you rebuild the entire perturbation theory. So in particular, I haven't told you what integral and star means. This is called, by the way, the Witten open string theory, because he first wrote this and defined many of these things. Not in this case, no. So phi can be expanded in terms of many ordinary fields, and some of these are auxiliary. So when you integrate out, you get higher point terms. But this, as it stands, only is cubic. So what this symbol means graphically is that you have three strings that meet like this. And so in particular, you can see that if I if I have a vertex like this and I do Feynman dot graphs, I'm going to be getting things like this. Okay, and so in fact, this action, this nice gauge invariant action, very similar in structure to things that we already know, reconstructs the entire perturbation theory of the string. That seems pretty good.
Joel?
Yes?
As you know, in the modern effective field theory, interpretation of quantum field theories, the action is always plus dot, dot, dot. Here, how do you know this?
The symmetry is very constrained. Does anybody here say with definiteness that no other terms are allowed by the gauge symmetries? Not, yeah, yeah. The symmetries are very constraining. In fact, just on physics grounds, I can say, you know, pretty certainly no other terms would be allowed. So it's not like effective theory where here you have enough symmetry to fully fix the form of the action. Okay, so coming back to what is string theory. You know, people walk around with Maxwell's equations on their t-shirts or Einstein's equations. And so eventually, when we answer this question and we know what string theory is, we'll have some equation, which hopefully fits on a t-shirt. That's a pretty fair candidate. I mean, that looks pretty nice. That would look okay on a t-shirt. So that's one possible answer. There's a question in the back?
Well, in quantum field theory, for example, one of Wilson's suggestions was the lattice is a non-perturbative prescription for integration.
Very good.
You have just an action. You need the measure as well.
Very good. Very good. In fact, this brings me to my next question. Okay, so before we put this on, before we print all these t-shirts and try to sell them, in order to give meaning to this path integral, we need not only the action, but as has just been pointed out, we need some prescription for defining this integral over all fields. And this is clearly involves subtleties of both mathematics and physics. And so what I'd like to do next is to point out an interesting subtlety about the about this theory as it stands. There are a number of subtleties, but there's one subtlety which is simple to explain and very striking. And okay, by the way, I this works for open strings. There is no direct analog for closed strings. One of the things is there's a funny thing about this action that it treats the midpoint of the string as special. The three midpoints of the strings that are involved in the interaction all touch each other. A closed string has no privileged point, no special midpoint, and this interferes with trying to do something similar for closed strings. What can be done for closed strings is highly non-polynomial, but also not very explicit. And in fact, as we go on, I'll mention later on, there's a deep reason. This may be kind of trivial that this has a midpoint and this doesn't, but there's actually at least one deep reason for thinking that open strings and closed strings are qualitatively very different in their nature. So let's see an illustration that shows the subtlety of it. We have only open string fields, and let me draw for you. So again, that action builds all kinds of processes. It builds this process. And it also worked, you know, this is two open strings exchanging virtual open strings. It also builds this process. It's going to be fun to draw. Let's see. Yeah. I practiced this quite a bit, but it's still. Yes. Did I get that right? Okay, what I'm trying to draw there, and I'll fix it, I can do a better job, is, again, two open strings exchanging a pair of open strings, except the exchange strings each are going to do that's very simple. The exchange strings are each going to rotate by 180 degrees on the way across. And by the way, this is still an orient for if you're interested. This world sheet is still oriented because if you make any closed path, you come back to where you started. But in the sum over world sheets, you automatically include everything of the same topology. And here's another world sheet that has the same topology as the one I've just drawn. It's I'm going to start by drawing a long cylinder and add a couple of maps. So this again, this picture and this picture have the same topology. If it's not obvious, one way to see this is imagine just grabbing. So there, in this world sheet, there are two boundaries. The lines you see are actually the edges of the world sheet. So if you imagine pulling those boundaries far apart, you'd have an open string coming in and going out on one boundary, and an open string coming in and going out on the other boundary, and then some long bit of world sheet without any boundaries that ties them together. So that's the picture that you get. And if you stare at that, you think that looks like two open strings interacting by exchanging a virtual closed string. And it is, and in fact, you have to have these, although we just started with open strings, you have to have the closed strings as well. This was actually discovered, I think, by before asymptotic freedom even, by Gross, Shirk, Schwartz, and Gross, Nouveau, Shirk, and Schwartz. Thanks. It's interesting because I believe this was discovered before people knew they were talking about strings. Back when people called this theory dual models. So there was something called a dual model, which turned out to be the quantization of a string, but nobody knew that. And you had the tree amplitudes, and you had rules, unitarity for building them into loops. And when you try to build the open string tree amplitudes into loops, what was found was there was a surprising long-range force between the open strings that hadn't been put in.
So they were then presumably part of some underlying field theory, then, right?
I mean, which the
this dual models that you're talking about. I mean, where did they come from?
They were a technology for directly writing down S matrix elements that came from strong interaction phenomenology.
So they did not start with a fundamental.
No, they were a clever way of writing down amplitudes that satisfied a bunch of physical properties that strong interaction amplitude should satisfy. Yeah.
But Joe, does the last remark that you made implies that if you have a string field theory for open strings, you would also then know how to describe closed strings?
Yes, this is where I'm going. But before I get there, one more historical point, which is shortly after Gross et al. Found this force, they actually when you look at it more closely, it doesn't, in general, have the right form to actually correspond to exchange of a physical particle. In most cases, if you tried actually to make sense of this force, you would conclude the theory is inconsistent, not unitary. It doesn't satisfy the principles of relativistic quantum mechanics. And Claude Lovelace, had the odd notion of asking, well, how does this depend on the dimension that the strings move in? Because up till this time, everything was four-dimensional, everything was aimed at the strong interaction, and what he found is that strangely, only in 26 dimensions, or I'm going to call 2610, working base 26. Anyway, so depending on, well, 26 initially, but 10 is really the number one should think about. Now, only in 26 dimensions did this amplitude really have the right form to correspond to something that came from a physically sensible theory. This discussion here still goes back to around 1970, and this was the first sign that the theory was supposed to live in something other than four space-time dimensions. And this was an annoying problem, but it didn't go away. And in fact, this need for being in other than four dimensions is now understood from many different points of view. Roughly speaking, you know, we're trying to quantize an object that has an infinite number of internal degrees of freedom. So there's a big potential for divergences and anomalies and things that don't work. In fact, it's a miracle that it does work in any dimension, but in fact it does work in, again, 26, or in the supersymmetric case, 10. And that's not so bad once you're thinking of a theory of gravity, because it's a very old idea that the physics that we see is a reflection of the geometry of some highly curved extra dimensions. And so this is now a feature, these dimensions, not a bug. But the closed strings are interesting because we started from an action and a path integral that had only open string fields. And yet we found that there are physical closed strings, including gravity. Now, you could think, okay, they're bound states or they're solitons. I mean, we know how to make things out of other things. But these are neither. Neither bound states nor solitons seems like a good analogy for what's happening. What's really happening here is that in the path integral over these functions of functions, you're integrating over a very big space. And this effect is really coming from the bigness of that space. It's coming from not the divergence, but the whole infinite tail of states. It's something which doesn't, I think, have an analog in quantum field theory, and which is special to this theory. And so the discussion up to here was about sort of just string theory. So lesson one, very old. Open string field theory must include closed strings and gravity and extra dimensions. Lesson two, if you try to make a field theory of open strings alone in this very elegant way, you find that it contains, in some mysterious way, closed strings as well. And so again, the question is, are the appearance of closed strings here a bug or a feature? And we don't know. There are sort of two classes of ways to address this. So you can regulate things. You can replace this vertex with one which is, so this is three strings all meeting at their endpoint. You can thicken it out a little bit. This cuts off the sum over states in a way that you no longer get the closed strings for free, and so there's some larger theory in which you add in closed strings as well. But there's another point of view which may be closer to the truth, which is that this is the right way to do things, that the open strings are, in a sense, the fundamental degrees of freedom, and the closed strings should, in some sense, be emergent. So I mentioned that there were asymmetries between open and closed strings, and so now let me just mention one of the deepest ones. When you try to study the quantum mechanics of black holes, assuming that gravity can be described by a quantum field theory, you get what seem to be disturbing answers. You find that black holes violate quantum mechanical purity, and you find that seemingly black holes have an infinite number of internal states, even though there's this nice Bekenstein-Hawking entropy that you get from the laws of black hole thermodynamics, which would assign them a finite entropy. And this has been a puzzle for a long time and seems to point to the idea that gravity has to be thought about ultimately in a much more radical way. Gravity is not defined by a field theory, at least maybe as an effective theory it is, but as a fundamental theory. It is not described by any kind of local or even quasi-local field theory. The degrees of freedom, the fundamental degrees of freedom from which gravity emerges are highly non-local and, roughly speaking, live on the boundary of your system, wherever that is. So gravity and closed strings are supposed to be holographic. So, now, it's not precisely clear how this funny feature connects to this idea of holography, but, well, they're both weird. To some extent, they're weird in the same way. They both involve the idea that closed strings want to be on the mass shell, not off shell. So maybe this is the right thing to put on the t-shirt, but what it tells you is that in understanding the measure of integration, you really have to, again, understand this. You have to incorporate this physically important idea that the closed strings, although they're not in the action, they're in some sense hidden in the measure. Anyway, so the segment on string field theory was in part directed at understanding the space of string fields. A couple of years ago, Martin Schnabel was able to write down some interesting non-trivial solutions to this theory. So you see there's a G, a coupling constant, in front of the interaction. Perturbation theory is fields of order 1. But there are some interesting Schnabel found, and building on other work, Schnabel found interesting nonlinear solutions in which phi, instead of being order 1, is of order 1 over the coupling. So it's really using the machinery of field theory to move out to non-trivial solutions. The most physically interesting ones are ones that describe, for example, annihilation of brains and anti-brains, which is a process that may have actually happened in the early universe. And so this technology is, that is for now its killer application. One still can't claim that this measure is understood, but people are trying to figure out what the rules are. We're trying collectively, many of us over tens of years, to emulate what Ken Wilson did all by himself for quantum field theory. Okay, so that's part two.
Joe?
Yes?
In quantum field theory, you start out with some scale field theory, and you go on to decorate the scale field theory, all kinds of indices, space-time.
Yeah, yeah.
Could one imagine doing something like that here?
Well, there actually is the freedom to add indices on the outside. The weird thing is, though, you can think of this as already a theory that has lots of indices. And I'm not really the one to speak to this, but if you try to think of this as not a string theory but a field theory, where the field lives at the midpoint, then in some sense each half of the string is like a big index. And this seems to have some kind of elegance, you know, that there may be some larger structure in which that's the right way to think about this. But this is, yeah. Yeah.
What's the physical meaning of this solution?
So the solution that Schnabel found is, again, this theory. So these theories have, besides strings open and closed, they have brains. They have higher dimensional objects. Some of these are unstable, and so Schnabel found the string field that corresponds to the annihilated the brain after it has decayed and there's no brain left, starting from so there's two points in the field space, having a brain, not having a brain, and they differ by an amount of order 1 over g, and he found out how to go from one to the other, at least in one direction.
But here you have sort of a process going from a brain to a no brain, but you do not see the, let us say, the closed string gas that has disappeared.
Exactly. These two points in field space are better understood than the entire sort of, you know, process that connects them. But that's, again, that's one of the questions. There are some decaying solutions. I'm not sure to what extent they include the radiation.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Let me move on and just sort of this. I'm just trying to give you a flavor, and so there's something to take away, and together with the fact that it lives in a space that is not fully understood and has this interesting physics. Now, supersymmetry is a symmetry that may be a symmetry of nature, or at least there are many quantum fields theory that have it to turn bosons into fermions. The alpha here is some kind of spin index. And it has many nice properties. For example, okay, it's a symmetry, so that means it commutes with the Hamiltonian and the momentum. But also, Lorentz invariance and so on require another part of the algebra. If I have two successive supersymmetry transformations, they give me, in fact, an ordinary space-time translation. Okay, that's a Dirac matrix. Okay, so it's a pretty simple algebra, and it's not hard, for example, to write down the general representation, the most general way that particle states might transform under such an algebra. And theories that have these properties have lots of nice properties. They tend to be more solvable than field theories that don't, and to have, I'll give you a cartoon of why that might be true. If I drop the indices, I have here on the right the Hamiltonian, the left the supercharge, and so roughly speaking, this is saying that you can take the square root of the Hamiltonian. And again, roughly speaking, to diagonalize a Hamiltonian, you have to solve second-order differential equations. So to solve the theory in this case, you only have to set to solve first-order differential equations. Now, because they're coupled, they're not intrinsically simpler than second order, but what you can do is you can find a large class of special solutions, so-called BPS solutions, that don't have any analog in non-supersymmetric theories. And if you have a quantum field theory, where you know a large collection of its solutions, you can often piece out its phase diagram. And in particular, one of the most striking features of the phase diagram is that when the coupling gets strong and things get complicated with lots of interactions, there is often some dual description, some other set of variables in which things become weakly coupled and classical again. So one of the nice things about supersymmetric theories is they're more solvable and have dualities. Another nice thing is they have better stability properties, because if the Hamiltonian is a square, it's positive. Now, this is a cartoon of the whole story, but this puts some constraint on the extent to which states can decay to lower energy states. And it's true that in a variety of different ways, supersymmetric theories are more stable than non-supersymmetric ones. This is one reason that they're likely to be, at some energy scale, asymmetry of nature. It's also why they are actually necessary in a consistent string theory, because string theories without supersymmetry always have rapid instabilities, which are absent in the supersymmetric case. So I'm making a list of nice things before I get to the things that are not nice.
What is a rapid instability?
Well, it's what we call a tachyon. So it's yeah. Well, it has one loop tachyons. Yeah. You wouldn't want to live there. To write down quantum theories that have these properties. So we're used to having fields that are functions of position, but you can extend that to fields that are functions of position and to some fermionic coordinates which have the property that they anti-commute, which has as a corollary the fact that any one of them squares to zero. You have these extra dimensions, but they're very small, because if you try to take two steps in any of them, you get to zero. But this is nice, and this is very pretty. Although, in fact, if you try to write down actions, Hamiltonians, in this way, you find that this formalism. So by the way, if supersymmetry were found, this is why, again, one of the taglines is it would mean the discovery of extra dimensions, not the big classical ones of Kaluza-Klein theory, but sort of quantum extra dimensions. But in fact, when you try to implement this, it's not so easy. In fact, what I've described here has too many degrees of freedom to be a physically sensible theory. And in order to make a physically sensible theory, in this case, it's not so hard. You either add a gauge invariance to remove some degrees of freedom, or you actually consider fields that are chiral, that depend only on, say, these coordinates are complex. So only on, roughly speaking, on the coordinates and not on their complex conjugates. And with these two ingredients, you can make quantum field theories that you can write down the most general quantum field theory that has supersymmetry in four dimensions without gravity. That is, you can take the standard model, and the squarks and the gluinos and all those things are described by this formalism. Now, when we want to go on to gravity, well, okay, thinking along these lines, you start thinking that maybe I need a metric where the indices now run both over the ordinary dimensions and these fermionic dimensions. And in principle, that's true, but this is many too many degrees of freedom. And so you start to need, in addition to this extra dimensions, you need tricks. So in order to do just the simplest case, you needed the trick of considering fields that depend on only half the thetas. In this case, you need many complicated and interlacing constraints. And it's tremendously puzzling that what I've told you here is basically something that you get any graduate student can learn. It's a standard part of an advanced quantum field theory course. Writing down general relativity, again, any graduate student can learn the rules of general relativity from a general relativity course. But if you take general relativity and supersymmetry and try to make this more symmetric theory that has both, it takes basically a specialist. Following this thread that I'm described here, it's, I don't know, 50 dense pages of equations in Wesson Bagger to get to the final answer. The final answer is simple. It's just a spin 2 field and a spin 3 halves field, both massless and coupled. But somehow there's this paradox that the formalism, the physics, I started by talking not about physics, but not about formalism, but about physics to emphasize that these theories are physically nice. The formalism has lagged behind for some mysterious reason. And so supergravity is, again, still, although gravity and supersymmetry are available to everybody, supergravity is mostly the domain of experts. And now when you come to supersymmetric string theory, again, you might think that I now have a string where the coordinates of the string live in one of these superspaces. And you'd be sort of right. Yes?
Sigma,
thanks. You'd be sort of right. Actually, the existing formal, the kludged together textbook formalism for describing supersymmetric string theories doesn't take advantage of supersymmetry. The supersymmetry emerges at a late stage, but it kind of works. And if you try to make supersymmetric string theories, again, the same problem. You've got too many degrees of freedom here. You've got to introduce some gauge symmetry that gauges them away. But when you look covariantly, this approach was first written in 1984. And I think I predicted that in 25 years, people would still be trying to quantize this theory. Maybe I said 50. Well, it's now 25, and I'm willing to renew it for another 25. Because, again, for some reason, this is very hard. And over the last few years, Nathan Berkovitz, my co-organizer, has been developing this idea of pure spinners, where you have the superspace where, I'm going to call them theta, not lambda, just to stick with the notation I got. You have a superspace with a nonlinear constraint that if you take two of these spinners and you make a vector out of them, you get zero. These are called pure spinners. And the formalism for this is still under development, but it seems to be becoming the state of the art for understanding supersymmetric string theories. And so when Matthias pointed out that a proof was lacking for the perturbative finiteness, in some sense, in the bosonic theory, you can sort of mod out the tachyon, ignore it, and produce a proof. The theory that doesn't have a tachyon, the supersymmetric one, what is still lacking is a sufficiently transparent manifestation of the supersymmetry. And this would have many implications for both practical calculation, for proving things, and also, actually, for what is string theory? The candidate, the string field theory, the T-shirt candidate that I wrote for you before, actually doesn't work because it's not supersymmetric. And so Nathan has provided, for the first time, a serious candidate for what goes on the t-shirt using these pure spinners, but it's not quite as pretty. So the second segment has been the development of these pure spinners, and I should say, supersymmetry is something that mathematicians generally don't seem to relate to. You know, you can tell them what it is, and they just—it doesn't. I think it's fair to say it doesn't resonate with things in mathematics. Pure spinners seem to have a greater resonance to mathematicians. Is that fair to say, Dave?
Yeah.
And so maybe this is a sign that we're finally learning, you know, how to think about supersymmetry in the right way, and so someday we'll be able to write down supergravity with just as much ease as we can write down Einstein gravity. Okay, so part three, and so part four, 10 minutes should be just about right. So I'm going to write down another candidate for a sorry question. A fermion satisfying this constraint, and it's related to things like twisters. Again, I'm only going to say the words, but it's related to things that mathematicians like. The field is a boson. Okay, yes. So wait.
It's a fermion, right?
Well, it's a boson with a spinner index. It doesn't, on the face of it, satisfy spin statistics. Although the theories that you get from it do. Though I confess, this is not my field, and I can't tell you why they do.
It's a ghost.
It's a ghost. Okay. Well, that's. I didn't mean to talk about ghosts. Okay, so it's this. So this is actually what this is the part that you subtract out. Good. So this is the part that you subtract out, so that you're left with only the physical degrees of freedom. It's a ghost. Good. So again, the idea was you have too many degrees of freedom. You have formalisms that subtract degrees of freedom, and this is the subtractive part. Good.
You take out the mathematically sensible part, and you get the physical degrees of freedom.
Okay. This is what I've always said. So, another thing that you might put on your t-shirt is but if you had that on a t-shirt and you were walking down the street, no one would know that you were a string theorist. They would all think that you were a quantum field theorist. Maybe you work on the strong interaction, because this is just like the standard model. Let's just see a little less than the standard model. It's got a non-abelian gauge field and some kind of fermion that couples to the gauge field. No strings, no gravity, black holes. But in fact, remarkably, all of those things are in there. So I used this word duality before as sort of a theory that has sort of different limits. One way to think about it is you have a single quantum theory, which has many classical limits. And so there's a quantum theory, one of whose limits is this, super Yang-Mills. So it is supersymmetric. That's why the fermion is included. And the other limit is string theory. In all of its glory, it's actually string theory in a certain kind of a box. It's in a box that has a certain kind of boundary conditions. And again, this theory has two classical limits, but this limit, which is just a quantum field theory, we know how to quantize. We know how to write if we know we have this classical limit, we know how to write the full quantum theory. Wilson has told us. And so this, what we know about this theory, already defines the whole thing. And so this does provide an answer, another answer, a seemingly completely different answer to the question, what is string theory? What is string theory if you put it in a certain kind of a box? Get back to, by the way, this box, well, it's hard to put gravity in a box, as you might imagine, because it But ADS 5, anti-de Sitter space, one of the, if you want to think about it, when you hear anti-de Sitter space, one of the things that makes anti-de Sitter space special is it's a good box for putting gravity in, because the walls will reflect gravitons. And in fact, people were using, I think Gibbons and Hawking were using it for this purpose long before string theorists, you know, found its nice properties. But anyway, so here's an answer, at least for strings in this kind of box, here's an answer. And again, it's tremendously economical in terms of concepts. There's nothing here. Everything here is just from a quantum field theory textbook. To unwrap this, to see how this could possibly be in here, is a tremendous amount of machinery and understanding a lot of stuff. Even how this was derived is a long and interesting history they don't have time for. It was largely driven by the paradoxes of black hole quantum mechanics. You see, you can, in this box, you can make a black hole and watch it evaporate. And people studying the evaporation of black holes in string theory noticed curious coincidences between calculations done in this theory and very seemingly different calculations done in this theory, that was finally crystallized as this idea that you had a real duality for which there's now no proof. There's no way to go from this to this in an algorithmic way, but there's overwhelming evidence. Another thing that would be nice for some future program to provide, it probably won't be on in this one, is natural. Well, I take that back. There's ideas out there. A proof that what I've told you here is true. But this tells you many things. Again, it provides you better than the previous t-shirt, because we know exactly what this is. It provides you an algorithmic definition of this side. But also there's calculations that we need to know how to do over here that can tell us new things about strongly coupled gauge theory. And remarkably, these are useful to understand heavy ion experiments, and they may give interesting models of condensed matter physics. But in my last couple minutes, I'll just mention what the particular goal or activity of this third segment is. So you've got a couple of parameters to play with. You've got the size, these are matrices, you've got the size of these matrices, and you have the coupling constant, actually times n. And when the size becomes large, there's an old observation of a Tuft that the Feynman graphs on the one side of the equality become planar. So instead of lines crossing each other, you can draw them on a blackboard flat. And on the other side, of course, you've got strings. And so it's actually an old idea of a Tuft, which is partly realized by this duality that the large end limit of a gauge theory should be a string theory. But what's interesting here on both sides, and Tuft's ultimate goal and n's ultimate goal is still to apply this to QCD, to the real strong interaction. But what you have here on both sides is basically a one-dimensional system. The string is obviously one-dimensional, but also the Feynman diagrams can be written flat, so you've got sort of one space and one time dimension. And one-dimensional systems are supposed to be simpler than three-dimensional systems. There's lots of methods for solving them, and one of them goes back to beta, the beta ansatz. In some one-dimensional quantum mechanical systems, you can write down the exact many-body wave functions. They're just a product of single particle wave functions times a phase factor or a matrix that depends on their order on the line. And this is pretty neat. And it turns out, it's not true for all one-dimensional systems, but it turns out seemingly that on both sides of this duality, that extra symmetry is present, and one has the ability. If anybody who has ever worked on this knows, it's a very technical subject, and you work very hard for small amounts of progress. But in fact, there is evidence that on both sides, one can sort of write down the exact wave functions. And so you have this theory with this duality where you can calculate it when G is small, and you can calculate it when G is large. And there's increasing indication that for certain quantities, one can calculate their full G dependence, which would be a remarkable, it would be a tremendous step forward in understanding and applying this duality. Just last week, three of our program, before they arrived, so we don't get credit for this, but Kazakov, Gromov, and Vieira Actually, maybe you, Pedro, were you here on the day the paper went out? Anyway, that's kind of cheap. Anyway, made what seems to be, if I understand correctly, a tremendous leap forward in this subject, because these Beta-Ansatz methods are most useful for infinite systems, where, and you really want to apply them to a string where you have either a periodic system or endpoints. And there's been ideas out there for a very long time about how you would go from your understanding of the infinite system to the understanding of the finite system. And so the thermodynamic Beta-Ansatz, for example, gives you the ground state energy, but just the ground state energy in the finite system. And my understanding is that these three people have generalized the thermodynamic Beta-Ansatz in such a way that they can now get all of the states of the finite volume system. And so I think we're going to hear about that starting on Wednesday. Some real progress in that direction. Okay, so this is the three sort of first three segments of our program. Just a couple of big questions that I'll mention. So this is pretty nice. And so again, you might ask, can we print the t-shirts now? What are we missing? And again, it's these boundary conditions. Now, ordinarily in physics, if you know what a system is with one set of boundary conditions, you know a lot about it. You know what its fields are, you know what its equations of motion are, you're basically done, you just have to change the boundary conditions. But because gravity is holographic, in some sense, everything lives at the boundary. And to go from the theory with this set of boundary conditions to a different set of boundary conditions requires new ideas. And so there's sort of two steps. There's first of all replacing this phi sphere with a less symmetric shape. And there's a lot that's known about this. Although still not shapes as asymmetric as we expect to have in nature. And the bigger leap is replacing antidesiderator 5 with something else. Because, again, what ADS 5 is putting gravity in a nice box. And you can't do cosmology in a box very well. So if you really want to understand string theory in all of its cosmological glory and understand initial conditions and everything else, then you need some leap beyond this answer to the question. And so anyway, I think as the program goes along, we're going to move less from sort of well-defined technical questions to more of these ill-defined big questions. Thank you.
Room for more questions, but I would like to get them from a non-participant. So not you, Bob.
So I have kind of a semi-sociological question. If LHC doesn't see supersymmetry, is that the beta string theory, or are there way out?
So remember that string theory lives at 16 orders of magnitude shorter than the LHC scale. And so the reasons, so there's string theory needs supersymmetry for reasons of stability, and so it needs it at some scale. And it certainly needs it at some distance below the fundamental scale. Because it
doesn't have to be LHC necessarily.
But it doesn't have the LHC. Now, I mean, the Higgs hierarchy problem is also in a generalized sense what I was calling a stability problem. And so there's a particle physics reason, not a string theory reason, for thinking that that scale is the weak scale. So sociologically, of course, one would like another lever on shorter distance physics, but unfortunately, for the reasons that I said, there's no guarantee there. Yeah.
So the related question is that, I mean, string theory, let's say, is now 25 years old. Let's start at 1994. Mm-hmm. And if you look at quantum mechanics, relativity, Maxwell's theory, even quantum field theory, in 25 years, we knew, I mean, if you take quantum field theory in 1949 or 1948, we had Wilson's work, Gates theory, QED, I mean, it's amazing amount of stuff.
Yeah.
Quantum mechanics, everything basically was done in 25 years. What has happened in string theory in terms of...
I do think the intrinsic, hardness of the subject contributes something, because you have quantum field theory and gravity. So even
before the answer doesn't hardness.
But I think that counts for because it has quantum field theory and gravity. So I mean, there's some claim to hardness. But the other thing, of course, is the tremendous leap of scale. You know, we're trying to, atoms, although you really can't compare the 19th century to today, but atoms was a case where there was good scientific reason to believe in 1800, and it was 100 years to figure out how big they were and ultimately to infer their existence. Yeah, it's scale. It's totally scale. Yeah, if you...
Did you use the word integrability?
Integrability is just, integrability has many definitions, and I'm using it only very loosely in the sense that it has some of the extra properties maybe that enable you to write down exact many-body wave functions. And in fact, again, not a precise characterization of how much information you get out of how much symmetry. I think it's.
So, Joe has answered all other questions. Well, now,
string field theory. Is super string field theory useful? String field theory, you talked about it, mostly.
So what I said briefly is that Nathan Berkowitz has provided a supersymmetric string field theory, which at least is a candidate for, unlike Bosonic string theory, which has tachyons and is only a toy model, a warm-up. The Berkowitz theory is at least a candidate for a well-defined theory of strings, a completely well-defined quantum theory. So, yeah.
How important is string field theory? Because all this has nothing to do, right? This ADS has nothing to do with string field theory.
Okay, that's a very interesting point, which is, right, I've given you two different ways to think about the subject, and it may have come through that I have more, I've given this one I strikes me as being very powerful because, it tells you at least conceptual things about quantum gravity, even if not, calculational. But again, there are limits to our understanding, and there's some clearly bigger or cleaner structure there, and maybe the string field theorists will get to it first. Maybe it'll be gotten to first from this side.
I think you shouldn't be too hasty to throw out theories with tachyons because tachyons just represent an instability of a vacuum, and there might be a stable vacuum.
Oh yeah, sure. Yeah. But the only theories that I know of that live longer than that are supersymmetric at some scale.
What about the Higgs theories of floating?
Okay, non-programmed.
With gravity. Sorry. Yeah.
Okay, well, let's thank Joe again.
That was great. Thank you.